This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the United Arab Emirates enters the fight in Yemen. Another push from U.S. Secretary of State Kerry for the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Small drones deliver blood to remote areas.
In places where you have landslides or mudslides or no roads or terrible traffic or some kind of natural disaster that takes out roads, they're not affected by those issues at all.
A young hip-hop artist makes some noise on the internet. These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Forces backing Yemeni President Abdu Rabu Mansour Hadi have recaptured an important military base from Houthi rebels as they continue a push to reverse the Houthi campaign that forced Mr. Hadi to flee the country in March. After several days of fighting, the pro-government forces, backed by airstrikes from a Saudi-led coalition, seized the Al Anad airbase located about 60 kilometers from the port city of Aden. Pro-government sources said the fighting left 70 Houthi rebels dead and dozens captured, with at least 24 loyalist troops killed. The United Arab Emirates joined the conflict, moving a brigade of troops along with tanks and other armored vehicles into Yemen. This is the largest insertion of foreign troops so far in the Yemen conflict. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Michael Stevens, director of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar, about the significance of the United Arab Emirates' entry into the fight.
Well, certainly what we've been seeing in recent weeks is quite a dramatic turnaround in the fortunes of the government of Yemen. And this clearly has been done with the backing of the anti-Houthi coalition led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. I think this is the first time now that we have had direct evidence, however, that the GCC has been directly involved in deploying arms, deploying troops into the fight. And it seems to me that evidence is clear and uncontrovertible that the Emiratis have put in a brigade of troops and they're invested in the fight for the long term. So this isn't very good news if you're a Houthi, of course, because as the tide has been turning, it's been coming increasingly clear that the GCC is investing more and more in the defeat of the Houthis and is willing to put its money where its mouth is and deploy troops on the ground.
Well, since the Saudis are the driving force behind what's going on the Sunni side of the conflict in Yemen, why is it that the Saudi army did not go in?
Well, so far, the Saudi army has not been detected going in. That doesn't mean they're not there. I think it's reasonable to assume that given the dramatic increase in performance of the units fighting in Aden in recent weeks, that there was some military activity to support them going on. It's most likely to be special forces. Of course, the Saudis are not going to admit to this. In fact, they flatly denied it. But let's be honest here. Those groups that were fighting in Aden a few weeks ago were a ragtag bunch of militias that had no chance of defeating the Houthis. Now they've run them out of town, and now they've taken back a huge airbase 30 kilometers to the north of the city. So unless someone's waved their magic wand and these guys have turned from militias into efficient fighting troops, I think it's safe to assume that the Saudis are there. It's just that they've not been photographed deploying in the same way that the Emiratis have.
The Houthis and the people aligned with them are strongly entrenched in the northern part of Yemen. What does it take to extract the Houthis and their allies?
Well, it's a much tougher fight. Look, the Houthis are currently operating way outside their traditional heartland. They're not particularly popular in the south. They're not welcome there. I think what's possible right now is to push them back into their heartland, certainly to put them under squeeze in the capital, but to run them out of the northwest of the country where their tribal heartlands are would be almost impossible. If you're going to undertake military operations in the northern parts of Yemen, that you do it in a way which is not going to get you bogged down in a 20-year war, because ultimately the only people that can win from that are the Houthis. It's going to be a long fight yet, but the Houthis are clearly on the back foot now.
Michael Stevens, director of the Royal United Services Institute in Qatar, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Time now to check out what's trending on Twitter. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to bring us reactions to Abu Dhabi's placement of troops in Yemen on social media. Hello, G.
Hi, Ray. One account that's very actively using the hashtag Yemen under attack is the Iranian news network Press TV. It has two Twitter accounts, one regular and another one for breaking news. Its breaking news Twitter handle is @breaking_PTV. It tweeted, Doctors Without Borders says, health services in Yemen are nearing collapse. It used hashtags breaking news and Yemen under attack.
What about reaction from the United Arab Emirates itself?
Ray, the Dubai Media Office tweeted a picture of the UAE Prime Minister visiting an armed forces general headquarters in Abu Dhabi Tuesday. But that's as close as it got to mentioning anything about its military involvement in Yemen. The media office is on Twitter @DXB Media Office.
I see. Now, let's take a look at reactions from private accounts. How do people feel about the deployment?
Well, the overriding sentiment for tweets in English appeared to be quite negative towards Abu Dhabi's decision. And the case in point is writer and activist Tariq Fatah's tweet. He tweeted, Hundreds of UAE tanks in Aden, Yemen, the richest Arabs killing the poorest. Must be fun, eh? As you could tell from the tweet, Ray, he's a Pakistani-born Canadian and writes for the Toronto Sun. That's all for me today.
And thanks for the analysis, G. Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. You can follow her on Twitter @GAbbyLee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Malaysia, where he'll be taking part today in a forum of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. He's been using his trip through Southeast Asia to promote the benefits of the proposed 12-country Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, the TPP, that would encompass about 40% of global trade. Secretary Kerry discussed the TPP Tuesday during his stop in Singapore. VOA's Pam Dawkins is traveling with Mr. Kerry.
At a Singapore university, Secretary of State John Kerry said trade representatives made good progress last week in Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations in Hawaii, but they failed to reach a final deal.
As with any complex negotiation, I've watched them for years in the Senate, voted for them, may I say, for the trade agreements. There remain details to be hashed out.
He said a finalized TPP deal could raise standards in other areas.
Under this pact, every participant will have to comply with core international labor and environmental standards. Every participant will have to refrain from using underage workers, unsafe workplaces.
But analyst Greg Pauling of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the impact of those additional benefits could be limited.
A trade deal's ability to influence human rights is around the edges. It's not a human rights agreement.
The Asia Trade Center's Deborah Elms says getting countries with competing interests on board will be a challenge.
The real challenge is you have 12 countries with very different interests. Sometimes they're aligned, but many times they're not.
Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
The United States is not the only party to the TPP negotiations facing a tight deadline for reaching a deal. Rajiv Biswas is an economist with IHS Global Insight in Singapore. He spoke with International Edition's Victor Beatty about what else needs to happen for a TPP agreement to become a reality.
there may still be time for some, you know, final deal to be pulled together, but I think it would really need to be done in the next few weeks, or at least months anyway, so that the national parliaments of the TPP members can ratify the deal either by the end of this year or early next year. So that means there's a very narrow window. One of the sticking points in the current negotiation round was on dairy, where Canada really was holding out in terms of liberalization of its dairy sector, which seems to be its holy cow, if you like, that it doesn't really want to move substantially on that, particularly given they have their own elections coming up. So I think a lot of the negotiations are also getting stalled over every country's individual election cycle. There were a few other sticking points in relation to the autos deal between Japan and North America, and also in relation to biologics. But I think some of those may be more readily resolved than the dairy dispute. So the TPP negotiations are very, very close to a final deal. Some reports from ministers indicate 98% of issues have been resolved, so they're really tantalizingly close to getting a deal. And that's why it's so important to try to get that pushed through in the next few weeks and months, so that the whole TPP initiative doesn't get scuppered by the election campaigning cycle in the U.S.
Were you surprised that there was not a breakthrough in Hawaii?
I think it was clear that there would be difficulties in some areas, but there had been high hopes that, a deal would be reached, or at least the broad framework of a deal. So it is disappointing, I think, for many of the countries that a deal was not able to be done. Certainly, I believe that, you know, the TPP does deliver positive benefits to the member countries, and therefore it is a disappointment that it didn't go through at this time, because that would have worked relatively well in terms of the political timetable in the U.S. But now, the longer it drags on, the more difficult it will be to get through the political cycle, given the upcoming elections.
Japan's economy minister suggested that there could be another round later this month.
The key now will be the Canadian elections, because one of the issues that held up the dairy deal was that the Canadian government was concerned about its farm lobby and how that would play out in the elections. So I don't think it'll be meaningful to have another round of talks until after the Canadian elections. So as soon as those are over, then there would be leeway. But the problem is that after the Canadian elections, it's not that long before the U.S. election process gets underway. So it's a very narrow time frame that we're talking about. Certainly, a deal needs to be concluded by November this year, I would say. So the last chance would be at the APEC summit in Manila in November.
That was Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. The Greek stock market suffered a second day of losses on Tuesday after reopening on Monday from a five-week shutdown due to the country's debt crisis. Business correspondent Alexis Christophorus is in New York and spoke with International Edition's Michael Lippin about the continuing stock market decline.
Well, things weren't nearly as ugly as on Monday, Michael. On Monday, the Greek stock market closed down more than 16% on its first day of being open after a five-week shutdown. On the second day of trading, it seems like cooler heads prevailed. At one point, stocks were down as much as 5%, but they ended the day down just 1.2%. Again, we saw bank stocks leading that decline. Some of the bank stocks were down as much as 30%, and that is the market's daily limit. Meantime, we could have seen that bounce back, that slight bounce back in Greek stocks on news coming out of the European Commission. They say they believe a deal on a third Greek bailout could indeed happen by the end of August. They seem to be targeting August 18th or 20th. That's when the country has to pay over 3 billion euros to the European Central Bank. And there was a statement from an EC spokeswoman who said that the Greek finance minister says that talks are ongoing this week. They expect those talks to conclude with a deal by the end of August. So that must have been encouraging news for investors there.
Right. And another stock market that has seen big losses recently is China's. How is that market faring?
Well, they actually saw a nice bounce back. The Shanghai Composite Index ended up nearly 4% higher because Beijing clamped down on short selling. There are some new rules that now short sellers must wait at least one day to cover their positions and pay back loans used to buy stock. It used to be that investors could cover their positions the same day, and that added to a lot of volatility. So these new rules on short selling are just the latest measure that Chinese regulators are taking to help stem a 27% drop in stocks there since mid-June.
Now, there have been concerns that the Chinese economy is slowing. How is that affecting the shares of Apple, which is one of the major U.S. Consumer electronics companies?
That's right. Well, again, it's an example of just how global our economy is. There are worries that the Chinese economy is slowing, and China is one of Apple's largest growth markets. So that's putting some pressure on the stock. We saw Apple fall to a six-month low. It was down for the fifth straight trading day. It has now fallen more than 10% below its record close of $133 a share back in February, which means Apple stock has officially entered correction territory. Aside from China, there's some concern that there's saturation out there in the market. Many developed nations already have the iPhone or the iPad, so they're looking for upgrades now as a new revenue stream or an additional revenue stream for Apple. Still, Apple stock is up 7% this year. It had been up as much as 22%, and some analysts call this recent sell-off overdone.
VOA business correspondent Alexis Christopherson in New York, talking with my colleague Michael Lippin. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Created by an Indian physician 20 years ago, laughter yoga has been gaining followers around the world. Advocates say it has a variety of health benefits. In Manila, Filipino patients are using it to elevate their mood and energy and reduce stress. Pinoy Laughter founder Paolo Trinidad.
It changes their mindset. Instead of self-pity, it goes to resilience, it goes to empowerment, so they become very positive.
These patients, some who are battling cancer, say laughter yoga might be embarrassing at first, but force yourself to laugh and the world laughs with you.
Healing is not just yung chemotherapy and the medicines.
And that's nothing to snicker about. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition in Washington. Seven people have died and 86 others are infected in New York City's largest recorded outbreak of Legionnaire's disease. The seven fatalities are all older adults with underlying medical problems. 64 people have been hospitalized with the illness, a form of pneumonia that broke out July 10th in the Bronx. The disease is caused when water contaminated with the Legionella bacteria is inhaled into the lungs. The bacteria was discovered last week at a Bronx hotel and in equipment at a hospital. Officials have traced the likely cause of the outbreak to cooling towers that can release mist. Unmanned drones have been used to kill in modern warfare, but a much smaller version of the radio-controlled planes may become lifesavers. They could be used to speed biological samples from remote locations to hospitals where they can be tested. VOA's Jessica Berman explains.
Doctors usually want to run tests on blood samples as quickly as possible before they start to degrade. It turns out they may not have to. Scientists conducting experiments with a small drone have found that blood samples remained fresh after being airborne for 40 minutes. The possibility that biological samples could be transported safely from remote areas in Africa and other countries to state-of-the-art laboratories for testing is good news. According to Timothy Amukule, a pathologist at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, Amukule has been working with Uganda's Makerere University on the drone project. Where ground-based transportation comes to a halt, Amukule says hobby-sized drones do not.
In places where you have landslides or mudslides or no roads or terrible traffic, or some kind of natural disaster that takes out roads, they're not affected by those issues at all.
Blood samples are very delicate and can degrade easily if they sit for too long, as might happen if they get stuck in traffic. They can also be damaged by sudden acceleration, as might happen when a drone is launched. So they came up with a simple idea.
We designed a study to answer the question, can drones be used to transport blood samples?
The answer, it turns out, is yes. The investigators collected 6 blood samples from 56 healthy adults at Johns Hopkins Hospital. The samples were driven to a drone flight site 1 hour away. Half of the samples were packaged for the flight to protect them from leakage and in-flight environment, including a rise in temperature. The samples were loaded onto the drone, which Amukule and his team launched on several flights, lasting 6 to 38 minutes. The remaining samples were taken back to the lab without ever being flown. Amukule says both sets of samples were then tested.
We measured the 33 most common lab tests in both sets of blood samples, and we compared them, and they were essentially the same. So what that tells us is that blood samples can be flown in drones without any concern about deteriorating them.
The findings were published in PLOS One. Amukule says there are a number of advantages to small remote control operated drones. They can travel 100 kilometers in under an hour. They are less expensive than vehicles like motorcycles and will not get stuck in traffic. The next step is to conduct a pilot study in Africa, where point-of-care clinics are sometimes dozens of kilometers away from hospitals where biological samples can be tested. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
He is only 17, and yet Silento has a hit that is inescapable. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Border Crossing's host Larry London about the tune called Watch Me, and the young man who created it and became an internet sensation.
If you've been at a basketball game, a baseball game, a soccer game, a wedding, anywhere large groups of people get together, you have heard Silento's tune, Larry, Watch Me Whip, Watch Me Nay Nay. Although I think if I whip and nay nay, that might scare people.
There have been 90 million views of this video on YouTube so far and counting. And the song is currently number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 2 on the R&B charts. This kid is hot. His real name is Ricky Hawk. He's 17. He's entering his senior year at his high school in Georgia, and he goes by Silento. And he was asked why you call yourself Silento. He said, because I'm less talk, I'm more action.
Now watch me whip, kill it. Now watch me nay nay.
Okay.
Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Why me do it?
Now watch me whip,
kill it.
Watch me nay nay.
Okay.
Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Can you do it?
Now watch me. Ooh, watch me. Watch me. Ooh, watch me. Watch me. Ooh, watch me. Watch me. Ooh.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. Now, see, I think with a name like Hawk, you would probably want to keep that, because that's bad. That's like a bad name. That's like Avery Brooks.
Bad to the bone.
A man called Hawk. You know? Well, I mean, seriously, but so this is did he just, like, do this in his bedroom? He did some samples or some tracks or something?
Absolutely. He doesn't have an album. He's thinking about an EP. He believes in singles right now. That's what he said. It's all about singles, putting out singles. And this is his first attempt. And he's already won the Rap Artist of the Year Award at the Underground Interview Awards. And he's nominated at a Kids' Choice Award show for the R&B Hip Hop Song of the Year. So the guy's hot. You can't deny it. This song is already selling millions.
Well, that's the thing. 90 million views on YouTube. A lot of people are doing that, though.
Yes.
A lot of people are kind of bypassing the old school music industry, let's go to the record company thing. And they're just putting out their videos with their music on either like YouTube or SoundCloud or whatever. People are discovering him. And then the music execs go, hey, wait a minute. There's a 17-year-old in Georgia.
We've got something here. So the kid is popular right now, and he's doing very, very well. And continues to do well. In fact, he's talking about going out on tour and thinking about that. He was on the BET Award show recently, performed the song. So he's getting a lot of attention. He claims his influences are Usher, Mariah Carey, and Chris Brown.
All right. Well, that's good. You know, of course, if you want to hear this video, you can log on to YouTube. If you want to talk to Larry, send him a tweet. You can do that, VOA_music. Also, be sure to listen for his show, Border Crossings. That you can find on www.voanews.com.
Now I'm
do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news, information, and videos on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Efforts to combat human trafficking around the world have advanced steadily over the past 15 years. The Trafficking in Persons or TIP report issued by the United States Department of State has covered global trends to fight human trafficking since 2000. The 2015 TIP report evaluates the efforts of 188 countries and territories, including the United States, to fight modern slavery. Governments of many countries investigate and prosecute trafficking cases, provide protection to victims, and find new ways to prevent the crime from happening in the first place. Slowly and steadily, working together across borders and continents, the global community has been pushing back against the crime of modern slavery. Nonetheless, millions of people continue to toil in forced labor, exploited for the enrichment of others in virtually every country in the world. According to the International Labor Organization, people trafficked for labor and sexual exploitation bring in enormous profits, as much as $150 billion worth each year. And in 2012, the ILO estimated that there were 14.2 million victims of forced labor, primarily in agriculture, construction, domestic work, manufacturing, mining, and utilities. Too often, goods and services produced by forced labor are woven into the long and complex supply chains that cross multiple borders. Large companies may rely on subcontractors who use slave labor, and because there is little or no oversight, it is difficult to determine whether their products have been produced by persons held in compelled service. This means that the raw materials used to produce your phone may have been mined by victims of forced labor. Slave labor may have been used to manufacture the components of that office computer, or the men who caught, cleaned, or packaged the shrimp that made for such a tasty dinner were not paid for their labor. The private sector, civil society, and individual consumers can all help to eliminate the use of slave labor in global supply chains. Business leaders can establish and implement anti-trafficking policies to prevent and address any trafficking risks in their operations. Governments can strengthen and enforce the rule of law, examine their own procurement supply chains, and institute policies that respect workers. And everyone, including individual citizens, can affect change by only purchasing from businesses with transparent supply chains. Modern slavery is not a problem to be managed. It is a crime to be stopped.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.